Hello, friends. On this episode of Cold Brew, I am going to be sharing with you a missing person case from Asheville, North Carolina, back in 2000. There's been some developments in this case over the past few years, and hopefully that leads to closure soon. You are listening to Cold Brew, a true crime podcast fueled by Cold Brew Coffee. I'm your host, Caitlin Brewer, and if you like what you hear, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I would love to connect with you on social media. Follow me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Cold Brew Crime. Welcome to the second episode of Cold Brew. I am so grateful for all the kind words I received after the first episode aired, and I just wanted to say thank you to everybody and anybody who shared the episode or left me a review on Apple Podcasts. It's so, so helpful, and it really does mean a lot, so thank you. This episode, I'm actually drinking my Appalachian Java cold brew again. They were so kind to send me a full bag of coffee beans, and it was so delicious that I decided to bring it back for episode number 2. I would also love to feature some other small town coffee shops, so make sure that you tag your favorite shop on my most recent social media post, so I can find them and they can find me and we can all be friends. I had a few of you ask how I make my cold brew at home, so I thought I would share that real quick this episode. So I just get regular coffee beans, probably medium to dark roast would be better since it's going to be brewed over a long period of time. You don't want it to be super high in caffeine already or else you're going to die. So I would go with medium to dark roast, and you grind that up to like a really coarse grind, and then you get 3/4 cup of coffee grounds. I just dump mine into a regular size mason jar, bigger one. I don't know the size of that. And then I pour, basically fill the mason jar up, 25 ounces, and like give that a good stir, get it all mixed up, and then pop that in the fridge for basically 24 hours. Then when I take it out, I put a coffee filter in the bottom of my pasta strainer and then put that over a bowl that's slightly smaller than the strainer. And I just pour the cold brew in there. You gotta be careful. And I filter it depending on how the first one goes, 1 to 3 times. It's usually 2. And then I just pour it back into the mason jar and that's that. It keeps in the fridge for a really long time actually, so it's a great way to, you know, have your own cold brew at home. I'll be back with the case right after this. Our case this week takes place in Asheville, North Carolina. Where I'm from, in Burnsville, Asheville is the closest city. Like, the closest mall, the closest chain restaurants, the closest Target, Chick-fil-A, you know, the important stuff. It's really like that for a lot of the rural towns surrounding Asheville. We all travel to Asheville to shop and eat, go to the mall, hang out, probably watch a movie. I actually lived in Asheville for 2 years when I attended the University of North Carolina at Asheville. Asheville is truly such a unique city. It's surrounded by gorgeous views of the Blue Ridge Mountains, and it just houses a full array of beautiful people. It's really artsy. There's tons of unique artists and musicians, murals everywhere, and really historic older buildings. There's this vibe about it that's just really, I don't know the word. Cultured, maybe, is a good word. There's a lot of culture in Asheville. So if you're ever passing through North Carolina, Asheville should definitely be added to your to-do list, along with the Biltmore House. And if you don't know what that is, you just need to Google it because it will blow your mind. It's Sunday, January 2nd in the year 2000, and Zeb Quinn had failed to return home this day. Zeb was 18 at the time and was born on May 12th, 1981. That would make tomorrow his 39th birthday. Zeb worked in the electronic department at the Walmart located on Hendersonville Road in Asheville. Zeb loved his job, and even though he was only a part-time worker, he normally picked up shifts, you know, here and there, and basically worked full-time. He really considered a lot of his coworkers to be some of his best friends, and they were all tight-knit and knew a lot about each other and their personal lives. Zeb was also enrolled in classes at AB Tech, the local community college, and in high school, his mom stated that he found his place really in the ROTC program, but he did have some trouble fitting in. He had a minor social disorder. You know, she feels like it really kind of held him back from making and keeping some friends. Zeb really enjoyed fishing in the rivers surrounding Asheville on his days off from work, and he was saving up to buy himself a new car. Those who knew him would describe him as sweet, thoughtful, responsible, and reliable. So this night when he did not return home, his mom definitely knew that there was something wrong. Denise Vlahakis, Zeb's mother, paged him that night about dinner, and when he didn't respond, she assumed he was working and would get back to her when he could. She paged him later that night after returning home and still got no reply. It was not like him to ignore his beeper, so she called his manager and she confirmed that Zeb clocked out at 9 p.m. No one else that Denise contacted had heard from him. Okay, so fast forward a few days to January 4th, so this would be Tuesday. There's still no sign of Zeb. This is actually an episode of Disappeared on the ID channel, so I watched that and it really kind of seemed like his mom, because they interviewed her, it seemed like she and his sister had really frantically been searching for him, and I think we're just assuming that he maybe wanted some time alone or time away, and they weren't trying to intrude on him too much, and they just assumed he was gonna come home and be like, I'm sorry, I just needed some time. It's Tuesday, January 4th, still no sign of Zeb. Patty, his manager at Walmart, had answered a phone call in the electronic department, and the person on the other end said, "This is Zeb Quinn, and I'm calling to let you know I won't be coming in to work today. I'm sick." So immediately, Patty says that Zeb had never called in sick, or she thinks this, you know, like he's never called in sick, and she knew that this caller was not him. She knew him, they were friends, they, you know, she was totally aware of what his voice was, and this was not it. Patty, aware of the concerns surrounding Zeb at that time, she really acted fast, you know, and was like, okay, I need to figure out who this caller is. She asked the caller what department they worked in and what time they were scheduled to work that day, because if it was Zeb, they would be able to just say that right away. So the person on the line hesitated and tried to come up with an answer, but clearly was uncertain as to what to say. She couldn't call out on the phone in the electronics department, so Patty was able to keep this person on the line while she walked over to the jewelry department's phone. Apparently the cord on the phone was extremely long and she was able to do this. As soon as the caller hung up, she immediately dialed *69 to call that number back, because if you remember, that used to be a thing and was really helpful on home phones. The call was picked up by the Volvo Construction Company. Patty immediately knew something wasn't right. She called Denise, who immediately called the police to disclose this missing person, her son, and to hopefully file a report and share this information. Patty started questioning other employees, and I guess, you know, they all kind of started talking about it. Where really could Zeb be? And a few employees actually remembered seeing Zeb on Sunday leaving the parking lot with this man named Jason Owens. Jason Owens was a part-time stockman who usually just worked the night shifts. I mean, most people knew that they were acquaintances, but didn't really know any more than that. You know, Jason wasn't there all the time, and that was that. One employee actually even mentioned that they thought Jason worked at Volvo, but they weren't sure. Patty shares this with the police. They go to, you know, question Owens to find him. Owens actually admits to making this phone call, but he said that Zeb had actually asked him to do it, and that Zeb was afraid of being told no, I guess, when he called in to work, so he asked Jason to do it. Obviously, this is a little suspicious to the police. They continue to question Owens, and he tells them his story from Sunday night. Jason's story was they had made plans earlier that day, him and Zeb, to go look at a car that Zeb was interested in purchasing. Because like I said earlier, he was saving up for a new car. And Zeb clocked out at Walmart at 9 p.m. They met in the Walmart parking lot and they both left driving their own cars. They drove individually. On their way, they stopped at a Citgo gas station just down the road to grab something to drink. According to Owens, after leaving the gas station, Zeb flashed his lights to signal him to pull over. Zeb tells him he's received a page on his beeper and he urgently needs to make a call. He has to go find a payphone and he tells Jason just to wait there. He'll be right back. Jason says that Zeb came back like 10 minutes later and was totally frantic, canceled their plans, and just like hightailed it out of there, was in such a rush that he rear-ended the back of Jason's truck. Jason says he even tried to stop him, and you know, Zeb was just like, well, I'll pay for it later, I just have to go. So this was the last time that anyone saw Zeb. There was video surveillance footage from the gas station that does show both of them inside. They both get a drink. You can see Jason's Ford pickup pulling away, you know, like the lights pulling away, and then Zeb's light blue Mazda Protege following behind him. It looked like they were headed toward Long Shoals Road. They discovered from Jason's employer that he had called in the next day, and he claimed that he had been in an additional car crash and that he was pulling out of the Waffle House that night and, you know, basically hit a car, suffered a broken rib and some minor head injuries, and had been in the hospital. The police found no incident report, and there was basically no damage to his truck, so this was immediately, like, not okay. Jason becomes a person of interest, but they were unable to charge him with anything. So detectives begin reviewing the missing person report, and they start looking into people, you know, that are noted as close to Zeb, because when his mom fills it out, you have to list, like, people that could be closely associated with him that could know more information. Misty Taylor was listed as a friend on the report. Zeb's mother says that he was really infatuated with Misty and that the two of them would spend hours on the phone over the past few months. They were just, from what Zeb's mother knew, really good friends. Zeb had also shared with friends and coworkers about these long phone calls with Misty and his feelings for her, and that, you know, he hoped that it would become more. The police go to question Missy. She legit just says, like, yeah, I know him, but we're just acquaintances. We're nothing more. Like, denies basically any phone calls she has with him or really knowing that much about him, period. So Missy also has a boyfriend who is named Wesley Smith. They have a baby together, and she initially had kept this information for Zeb. And once he found out, he was obviously confused, but once she told him her reasoning, he was accepting and was just like, you know, okay. So she basically tells him that Wesley is abusive and she's trying to get out of the relationship, but just needs, you know, to figure things out a little bit. So Zeb, cool with it, whatever, they keep talking. So eventually Wesley finds out about all these phone conversations between the two and that they talking a little bit more than friends. Zeb had told a few coworkers that he was concerned about Misty on New Year's Day when he hadn't heard from her, and that this was right after Wesley had found out about them. Zeb's grandmother was at Zeb's house that night, and Zeb goes to call her to check on her, but he forgets to block the call by dialing star 67. So basically, he immediately knows, like, I have messed up. I forgot to block the call. Zeb's grandmother thought that that might mean trouble. And again, don't forget that Misty denies any type of relationship that she might have had with Zeb. So now the police have gotten Zeb's pager records, and they see that the last pages received were from his mother, which he obviously didn't return, and one from his paternal Aunt Ina Eustich that was received on January 2nd. He really wasn't very close to his Aunt Ina. They had not been in communication much at all before the disappearance, so this was pretty strange to Zeb's mom. When they questioned Ina, she denied making the page. Just like, no, I literally never called anybody, and said that she was actually at her friend's house for dinner that night. Her friend just so happened to be Misty Taylor's mom, and that Misty and her boyfriend Wesley were both also present for dinner that night at Misty's mom's house. Later that night, once Ina returns home, she calls to file a police report that her home had been broken into. Nothing was stolen, but she reported that some picture frames and other small items had been moved around, which to me is much creepier than knowing someone broke in to steal your things. Like knowing someone broke in just to move pictures around? Nope. Goodbye. Okay, so now it's January 6th. Denise gets a phone call from a fellow nurse at the Asheville Hospital, where they both work. This woman was also a former classmate of Zeb. And she tells Denise that she saw Zeb's Mazda protege in the parking lot of a barbecue restaurant adjacent to the hospital on her way into work. This is Little Pig's Barbecue, for those of you familiar with Asheville. It is really delicious. When the police go to examine this car, they found it with the headlights on. The windows were cracked. There was a lip outline, like someone had drawn lips on the back windshield with what looked like lipstick, and they had put what looked like exclamation points on both sides. And there was a live puppy inside. Okay. Like a literal black Labrador mix puppy chilling in the front seat. So clearly that was strange to the detectives. The car really looked as if it had been parked in a conspicuous manner, like someone wanted it to get found. You know, the lights were left on, there was a dog inside. Detectives believe that the puppy could have been to draw more attention to the car. You know, people are going to be like, oh, there's a puppy in this abandoned car. Whereas if it was just an abandoned car, it might not have gotten noticed as much. The detectives searched all the local animal hospitals and shelters and humane societies and had no luck tracking down where the dog might have came from. An electronic room key was also found in the vehicle, but had no logo on it, and unfortunately they were unable to locate the hotel or motel in which the key belonged, which is so unfortunate because I feel like that would have just been such an important factor. Denise does believe that whoever abandoned the car at this barbecue restaurant knew that Zeb had family that worked at the hospital, and they wanted them specifically to see it or find it, and they succeeded. 8 days after the car was found, there was a couple that contacted the police department and claimed that they saw a car that looked like the one described in Zeb's missing person profile driving around downtown Asheville days before. They tried to write down the tag number as best they could, and they took notes of the person driving, but they didn't call the car in until they had heard that Zeb's car had actually been found. The police asked the couple to come in for questioning. They were actually able to produce a composite sketch with the descriptions given by the couple, and the detectives were shocked when this sketch resembled none other than Misty Taylor. So they brought Misty back in for questioning, but she denied ever driving the car, again, basically denies her relationship with Zeb. She says this couple just made that story up, so the police had to let her go because they had really nothing to hold her with. One of the officers that actually worked on this case ends up adopting the puppy that was found in the car, and sadly, after this case goes cold. Years later, in 2007, detectives executed a search warrant on Owens' property in Leicester. Owens was named a person of interest in Zeb's disappearance, which authorities had changed at that time to a homicide, but Owens was not charged, and again, the case goes cold. Okay, so we're going to fast forward a bit to March 15th, 2015. A welfare check had been made on behalf of Christy Scowen Codd's father by the Buncombe County Sheriff's Office at her home at 87 Hooker's Gap Road in Leicester, North Carolina. In 2012, Christy had actually been a contestant in the 8th season of the Food Network series Food Network Star. Her husband JT and her had just gotten married in 2014. Christy's father had been expecting the couple to arrive at a family get-together in Mississippi by 4 p.m. on that Sunday. When the couple didn't arrive and couldn't be reached or weren't answering the phone, the family knew something was wrong. The deputies arrived at the home and immediately knew something was not right. Not long after they began investigating, they found themselves rounding up one of Buncombe County's usual suspects. Robert Jason Owens lived a little over a mile up the road from the Codds' home. He would occasionally do construction and yard work for them. Him and Christy were even friends on Facebook, but there didn't appear to be any more association than that between the two. Authorities interviewed Owens about his possible involvement with the Codds' disappearance. Owens was actually charged with breaking and entering, as well as larceny, after he admitted that he broke into the home. After getting search warrants, the deputies searched his home and found what appeared to be human remains inside the wood stove. Owens was then charged with two counts of first-degree murder and murder of an unborn child. Christy was 5 months pregnant at the time. Police believe that these killings happened on March 12, 2015, so 3 days before this welfare check. Owens' story to the investigators went as followed. He accidentally ran over the Codds as they were trying to help him get his truck out of a ditch, and then worried he would go to jail because he was heavily medicated that day. He dismembered and burned their bodies, sold their personal things, and moved their cars to make the crime look like a robbery. All right, Jason. To no one's surprise, this story was not supported by the forensic evidence that was collected, and the cops were like, bro, you did it. So, 4 days later, Owen's mobile home was actually destroyed by a fire in the middle of the night. By March 31st, 2015, police had obtained a search warrant for Owen's property in relation to Zeb's case. The warrants listed details from an interview that the police had with an unnamed relative of Owen's, who said, before and after January 2000, Owen's dug a pit on his property to burn something. The relative also told police that sometime after January 2000, Owen's poured concrete over that same area and said he was going to make a fish pond. The pond was never completed, and the relative said Owens later covered that area with dirt. Investigators said that they found fabric, leather materials, and unknown hard fragments buried on the property. According to search warrant documents released, the items were found under a layer of concrete on Owens' property. However, authorities have never said what these hard fragments were and whether or not they were related to Zeb. Okay, so now to more current news on these matters. After 2 years, Jason Owens pled guilty on April 27th, 2017 to 3 counts of second-degree murder and 2 counts of dismemberment for the 2015 murders of JT and Christy Codd, as well as the murder of their unborn child, Skylar. He was sentenced to at least 59 years in prison and is not eligible for parole. Months later, on July 10th, 2017, a Buncombe County grand jury indicted Robert Jason Owens with first-degree murder in the death of Zeb Wayne Quinn. As of January 2nd, 2020, 20 years after Zeb Quinn went missing, District Attorney Williams says the case is pending trial and he hopes to have a trial date set soon. Okay, I know that was a lot. I do just want to discuss a few points from Zeb's disappearance because to me, there really is a pretty obvious answer. I do think that Owens killed Zeb. I think that someone paid him basically to kill Zeb. And that person was probably Wesley and Misty. And they might not have paid him with actual cash, but he got some type of reward out of it. Literally, Misty and Wesley were eating dinner with Zeb's Aunt Ina, who apparently made this page to him that night. They needed a reason for Zeb and Owens to depart so Owens could say he doesn't know what happened to Zeb after that. They could have easily sent someone to Ina's house to make the page so it would show up on the records that that is the reason why he left. I really don't know. I don't know what anybody had to gain out of any of this. It's just awful. Why the car would be found with lips drawn on it and a puppy inside. I'm not sure what type of distraction they were trying to create by that, and why Misty was just seen possibly just cruising around in the car. I don't know. But whatever happened, I really think that the three of them were in it together. I think that Wesley and Misty have got off scot-free, and Owens is probably going to just have a second life sentence in jail after this court date, whenever that's set. So I'm really curious to hear what you guys think about this case, if you knew about it, or if you had previously done your own research on it, or what your theories might be as to what happened, if you think that Jason Owens is the guy, or, you know, if there could be some really strange thing with Aunt Ina, maybe. I would love to hear. Comment on my most recent social media posts to let me know. You can find me on all social media platforms at Cold Brew Crime. Cold Brew is recorded, edited, and produced by me. To be sure you don't miss future episodes, please subscribe to Cold Brew True Crime Podcast wherever you listen. If you like what you hear, please leave me a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. And don't forget to tag your favorite coffee shop in my last social media post. Thank you all so much for listening.